It's so good to be with God's people on a Sunday morning. I love Sundays. I love being able to read the Word together, to pray together, to be around other believers. And I'm sure you have, during your week, you probably have moments where you feel like you're the only one that's following the Lord in the whole country, or maybe the world. You feel like it's all stacked against you, and it's good to be with other people who are like-minded on a Sunday, who think the way that you think about God and who have the same worldview. This morning we're in Psalm 25. If you're visiting with us, we're working our way through the Psalms. Each summer we take a series of Psalms and we take one per week. So we're at 25. We started with 22 this particular summer. And this Psalm is really distinct from the other Psalms that we've looked at so far this summer. 22, 23, and then 24. They really form a great little triad of Psalms that are very specifically and very intentionally focused and obviously focused on the person and work of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. So we read about the crucifixion event, the Psalm of the Cross in 22. We see the Psalm of the Shepherd in Psalm 23, the great Lord is my shepherd. And we know that Jesus claimed to be the Good Shepherd in John 10. Psalm 24, we see the priestly role of Christ that's played out, that he is the one who can ascend the hill of God, and he has, in fact, ascended the hill and now making a way for us to ascend the hill of the Lord. And then we come to Psalm 25, and it reads very, very differently than these other psalms. I think this psalm will resonate with you because it reads a little bit more like we pray, right? If you were to take your prayer in your morning devotion time or evening or whenever that is, if you were to take that and write out a transcript and then try to outline it, what would that look like? If you tried to do a mind map of, okay, we went from here to here to here to here, my guess is it would look a little bit more like spaghetti than a road map, right? Just, we're kind of all over the place a lot of times when we sit down to pray. This psalm is a little bit that way in that it's cyclical. David will pray for one thing and have a meditation and then a prayer and another prayer. And as John Calvin said about this psalm, it's meditations mixed with prayers. And that's what we see happening in this particular psalm. It's different. The psalm also is organized in a particular way. The psalm is actually an acrostic, meaning that the first line from each verse, each new stanza within the psalm, starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And there are a couple little variations in there, but for the most part, that's the pattern. So it's an acrostic, the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, and so forth. So this is what's going on in this particular psalm. So on the surface, it may appear that he's all over the place. In fact, it's actually very organized and poetic and thoughtful. Some of you may be familiar with the New England Primer, the primer that was used for education in New England colonies, the late 1700s for educating children. It's a very interesting little read if you have a few minutes. Won't take you long to work through that. Used for educating children, and there's a series of lessons and prayers, and you learn your letters and your syllables and the vowels and how they go together and very basic grammar types of things. But there's also a lot of theology actually embedded into this New England primer. And there are two different versions, one for younger children, one for older children, of acrostics, which teach the biblical story. So one version, A is for Adam's fall, we all sinned. So kids would learn that. We learn A. What do you think when you hear that? A is for apple. Yeah, right. We've come a long ways from this. A is for Adam's sin, Adam's fall, we all sin. So it was used to teach theology in that way. B, heaven to find, the Bible to mind. So A, B, C, Christ crucified, for sinners died. And then I won't read all of them for you, but a couple others that I thought were really interesting. K, proud chorus troop was swallowed up. There you go. Teach your kids that one. Korah, the rebellion of Korah in the book of Numbers, or his troop, the rebels against Moses and Aaron, they were swallowed up in the ground. You just remind your kids of that. Yeah, chorus troop, and they were swallowed up. P, Peter denied his Lord and cried. We like sunshines and rainbows, right? Peter denied his Lord and cried. And then here was my favorite one. Why? While youth, that's the why, do cheer, death may be near. All right. Good night, honey. While youth do cheer, death may be near. It's an acrostic, and it's easy to remember things in that way. So this psalm, it's not going to be visible to you in our English Bible. It's basically impossible to translate it that way, to replicate the letters. There are 22 consonants in the Hebrew alphabet, and the vowels are not actually part of the alphabet. There are vowel pointings which tell you how to pronounce the word, and we have a different system in English. So it doesn't translate over, but that's the original design that's behind this particular psalm, is it's starting with A to Z, as it were, and that's why we're calling this sermon A to Z, praying from A to Z. It fits too because we use A to Z as sort of an all-encompassing phrase, right? Covered everything from A to Z, meaning you're just all over the place. And that's what we find in this psalm, is there's a lot of ground that's actually covered. I'll give you an outline for this particular psalm, but really it's not so much of an outline as it is a collection of thoughts from the psalm, and you'll see that. The psalm, it moves around in different pieces. We see trouble and deliverance, verses 1 through 3, truth and guidance, sin and guilt, animosity, and comfort. And the truth is, we could pick each one of these themes, and they are mentioned multiple places in the psalm, so it's a cycle that continues. And we see David working through a progression with this particular psalm. So trouble and deliverance. I want to read the psalm for us, and then we'll go back and look at these various points. Psalm 25 of David. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. For the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast, love and faithfulness. For those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. Who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distress. Consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes. And with you, what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem, O Israel. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. This prayer begins with a recognition of a pledge to trust in the Lord. Notice what it says. Verse 1. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. You know, knowing you should and could trust the Lord and actually trusting the Lord are not actually the same thing, right? Sometimes we know what we should do, but that doesn't mean we're actually doing it. I think many of us think that we're going to somehow grow in our trust of the Lord by osmosis. We just sort of think it a little bit and it's going to happen. At some point, just go to church some more, listen to a sermon on Sunday, we'll get there eventually. It's an intentional effort to trust the Lord, right? How do you grow in your trust of the Lord? You remember what the Lord has done. That was part of the philosophy behind this long psalm that we read just a little while ago. Look what the Lord did. You can trust him. He's trustworthy. We need to pledge to trust in the Lord. I love what C.J. Mahaney loves to say. He says, don't listen to yourself. Preach to yourself. Right? You can convince yourself of all sorts of things on your own. Don't listen to yourself. Preach to yourself. We've probably all had scenarios where you create something in your mind and you're just convinced it's absolutely true, and then you find out you were absolutely wrong. That ever happened to anybody? It happens all the time, right? Grab what you know to be true. You can trust the Lord and repeat it. Believe it. Trust him. Pledge yourself to trust in him. Grab what you know to be true. Believe it. We move into this idea of trouble and deliverance. We see this cycle throughout the psalm over and over and over again. You know, I was thinking this week about the various troubles that we all face. This is interesting to me. And I think if you've been a Christian a little while, or at least around believers, you probably know that you're going to experience trouble. You're going to have trials in life. You know that. But I think sometimes we wish we had somebody else's trial, right? Like, I know I'm going to have trials. I just don't want mine. I'd rather have his trial or her trial. And we have what we could call trial envy. I wish I could have theirs, not mine, because I know I'm going to have something. But if I got to have something, I really don't want mine. I want theirs. And we play this game in our minds of if I just had, I could deal with that situation, but my situation, you know, what a mess. I'd rather have his trouble than my trouble. But you have what the Lord has given you. You have your cup that you drink. David had all kinds of troubles. He was a victorious king. He was a mediator of a new covenant. He was a type of the Christ, the Messiah. But he was a mess, too. David was a mess. Y'all ever read about his life? I think sometimes we think about his victories more so than we think about the difficulty that he went through. Some of it was self-induced, which we'll talk about in a moment. But some of it wasn't. Just think about David's life. He was chased around the country by his former boss and the current king of Israel at the time. And he tried to kill him multiple times. Saul. I mean, that's disconcerting in and of itself, right? To get chased around by an army. You're hiding in caves. You're running from a guy that you know. His first son, Amnon, lusted after his half-sister, Tamar. He rapes her and then is eventually killed by his third son, Absalom. Now, that probably led to some awkward family dinners, right? Like, well, see, this is a mess. And some of us think, my family's a mess. And it may be. All right, it may be. But don't think the Lord hasn't used messy families before. He specializes in using messy families, actually. They're all messy. Absalom leads a revolt against David, seeks to kill him, and he eventually dies in battle before David. David knew all about trouble. He knew about being delivered from the Lord. And in a very real way, David understood, perhaps in a way that we'll never understand, he could say, if the Lord doesn't deliver me, I won't be delivered. That was the type of scenario and situation that David found himself in. So when he's talking about trouble, when he's talking about difficulty, we need to understand that he knows of that which he speaks. The end of the psalm picks up on this theme again. The end of his prayer in verse 19, he says, consider how many are my foes and with what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. God, I trust in you. That's all I can do. Now, if you're new to Christianity, or somebody has somehow given you the mistaken impression that you're never going to have problems or difficulty as a Christian, let me just apologize. and say that you have gotten the wrong impression. That is not Christianity. Jesus promised us trouble. The question is, who are we going to trust? Are we going to trust the Lord or are we not? Are we going to trust that he has resources to get us through or not? Trouble, deliverance, common theme. It cycles again and again. Next, we see this idea of truth and guidance. Truth and guidance. Verse 4, it says, make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Another common theme that's in this psalm and really in the Bible itself is the idea of learning. You never stop being a learner. You never stop. We're always learning. We don't ever get to hit cruise control in the Christian life. You don't get to say, oh, I know this one. I got this. We're always. There's a couple of interesting things that happen here in this psalm. There's a repetition of words that the psalmist uses. In verse 4, he says, make me to know your ways. Verse 4 again, teach me your paths. Drop down to verse 8. He said, good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. And then over in verse 12, who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. The way, his path. This word is an interesting word. It's direct. The way, the path. It's a beat down trail is the idea. A road, we could even say. He wants to know God's path, God's trail, God's road. God, teach me in my troubles and trials, your path, your way. You know, when you're walking through trouble, a trial, the most important thing is not figuring out how to get out of the trial. Okay? The most important thing is figuring out how to think rightly about your trial and your trouble. That's the most important thing. Not how do I get out. You know, the deliverance of God, his path, doesn't necessarily lead out of the trial. It may lead you actually straight through the trial. That may be his path, his way. It's this rich word, following the truth, following the way. How do we know the way? How does the Lord guide us? Well, he's not talking about some mystical experience where we need, you know, we blindfold ourselves and have some sort of a seance to figure out which way to go. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying, Lord, I need your truth to shape my mind and my heart so that I will walk according to your way, according to your path. Look at verses 8 through 10. He comes back to this again. He says, good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way, the path. He leads the humble in what is right, and he teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast, love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. The way, the path, the direct. God, lead me in your way, the path of humility. You know, we like the path of least resistance, right? We're like water rolling downhill. Which way gets me out of this the fastest? The path may not be the easiest way, but the path is God's way. Teach me your way. Truth and guidance. Teach me, Lord. Next, we see sin and guilt. Sin and guilt. You know, David's life, as we mentioned, was a mixed bag. He was a man after God's own heart, the man that God actually promised, I'm going to build my house through you. I'm going to build you a house. A covenant mediator, David was. But we know that David was a mess, too. He had his share of problems. You know, David is well known for his great sin with Bathsheba. I think we immediately think of that when we hear David's name. He has a situation that's arguably worse than that, though. It's when he took the census right at the end of 2 Samuel 24. David foolishly, arrogantly takes account of all his resources And this was basically a move to say, y'all look at this, I'm awesome, at the end of his reign. And the Lord had not instructed him to take such a census. But David does this against advice, and it's the flexing of the muscles of David saying, look at what I've done. Now we know from 2 Samuel earlier that the Lord said he was going to build the house through David. It wasn't David's doing. The Lord did that through him. But yet there's David taking credit. And it's really not all that much different than what Nebuchadnezzar did when he stood out on the balcony and said, look at my kingdom. What happened to Nebuchadnezzar after that? He got to go check out his kingdom from the back 40 for a few years, right? God said, no, you didn't do this. I gave it to you. This is exactly what happens to David. So David takes this census. He counts his resources as if to say, look at this thing that I've done. The Lord comes to him and he gives him options for punishment. Y'all ever use that with your kids? You know, hey, what do you think I should do about this? You've disobeyed in this particular way. What do you think I should do about it? Well, I've always thought as a kid, it's like, I think we should call it even, get it ice cream, right? I mean, a little grace here, Dad. Mercy? I don't know. But when you give them options, that's when it gets interesting. If you leave it open-ended, what do you think I should do about this? Forget about it. But when that's not an option, then it gets interesting. David's given options by the Lord for his punishment. 2 Samuel. Here's your options, David. You can have 3 years of famine. You can have 3 months of fleeing before your enemies. Or you can have 3 days of a plague that comes over Israel. Is there a D? 3 years of famine, 3 months of fleeing before enemies, 3 days of a plague. It's an interesting dilemma, right? David chooses the plague. And here's why. He gives us his reasoning there in the text. He chooses the plague because he thinks through it this way. If we have 3 years of famine, you're going to be dependent on other countries, right? You're going to be dependent on other people to somehow keep you alive. So you're going to need other resources. I don't want to put my hands in their, I don't want to put my life in their hands, right? Same with fleeing from his enemies. If I flee from my enemies, they're not going to be gracious or kind. 3 months of fleeing from my enemies. What if they overtake me? What if they overtake the people? The plague, though, was completely of God. Nobody could start it. Nobody could stop it. The Lord would do what the Lord did. And David said, I'm going to take my chances with the Lord. Take man out of this equation. God, you're gracious. You're kind. I'm putting myself in your hands, Lord. I've sinned against you. I deserve your punishment, God, and I'm putting myself in your hands. The Lord, on this occasion, deals very sternly with David. And there's 70,000 men that die as a result of David's sin. David begs the Lord, just take me. I'm the one who did it. But God brings a corporate punishment down on Israel. It's one of those situations that we don't really have a lot of insight into why exactly it goes that way. But we know that's what happens. David knew something about sin. He knew something about guilt, feeling guilty for sin. He was complicit, as it were, in the deaths of a lot of people because of his sin, because of his own arrogance, his hubris. It brought a lot of people down. We think about his story with Bathsheba, which is awful in and of itself. But really, there were a lot more people that ended up losing their lives as a result of David's actions because of this story. He knew what it was like to experience sin and guilt. Look at verse 6. Number of times in this psalm, he comes back to this problem that he has of his sin. Verse 6. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. For the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Then look at verse 11. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. And then again in verse 18. consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. I think we can spot a few truths that are embedded here in this confession that David has of his sin. Three things that we can see. We can see there's a realization. There's a realization with David that his forgiveness rests on God's mercy. There's a recognition that our forgiveness really isn't about us. And then there's a responsibility that he takes on, recognizing that his affliction, his own trial, has been brought on by his own sin. Let's look at each one of these. Realization, recognition, and responsibility. David has a realization. And this realization is that he doesn't deserve God's mercy. It's all about God's mercy. If you can deserve it, it's not mercy. If you've earned it, it's not grace. You don't deserve to be forgiven. I wish we could all wake up in the morning and look at ourselves in the mirror and say that. You don't deserve to be forgiven. We have not earned it in any way. God is merciful, and he gives it. What's the basis on which David is going to be forgiven? Look at verse 6. Remember your mercy, O Lord, Yahweh, and your steadfast love, for they have been from old. God, you've always been merciful. I'm asking you to be consistent. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. His basis for asking forgiveness is according to God's mercy, not because of something that he's done. Notice he didn't say, Lord, forgive me because I brought the sacrifices this month. Forgive me, God, because I've done some things for you. God, forgive me because I dropped a couple extra bucks in the plate this week. God, forgive me on what basis? What's your grounds for asking the forgiveness of the Lord? It's his mercy, and that's all you got. All right? There's nothing else. His mercy. His mercy is from old. His mercy is abundant. I've had so many meetings with various people over the years, and they'll say something like this. Well, you just don't know what I've done. God can't forgive me. And I usually tell them something along these lines. I usually say, you're right. I don't know everything that you've done. But the situation is actually much worse than you realize. They say, huh? I say, here's the problem. You are so arrogant that you think you are a better sinner than God is a savior. You think you're the only person on the face of the earth that has sinned so much that it's too much for God to actually forgive. Like, do you realize the Lord's forgiveness and mercy is abundant? It's free. It's huge. It's huge. God forgives. He forgives for his own namesake. He forgives based on his mercy. There's a recognition. There's a recognition in David. He mentions it here at the end of verse 7, for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. And then he does it again in verse 11, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. For your name's sake. There's a recognition that our forgiveness isn't really about us. It's about the Lord and about what he's up to and doing. You know, it's a great day in your life when you realize that not everybody's looking at you all the time, right? When you're in like junior high, you kind of have this like back of your mind. You just think everybody's staring at you all the time. And you come to realize later that not everybody's watching you all the time. And it's very relaxing once you finally realize that. When you realize, you know, it's really not all about me. I'm standing up here talking right now, the only person with a microphone, and I realize not everybody's even listening to me. It goes that way. It's very humbling realization. If you just laughed at a reflex, there was a joke embedded in that you missed, all right? It's very humbling for us to realize that we're not the center of the universe, and it's very humbling for us as Christians to look and to recognize that the Lord forgives, but it's not because we're awesome. It's because he's awesome, and he wants to magnify his own grace and mercy in our lives. And the awesome news is you get to be a part of that. Isn't that cool? The Lord is making his name known. For his sake, he's going to do this. Why does God forgive David? Because he's rich in mercy and has been for a long time, and for his name's sake. So that 2,000 years later, a little group of folks in North Florida can look back at some ancient king in Israel and say, look how the Lord forgave him. Wasn't he a mess? For his name's sake. That's what we're doing this morning. The Lord does this for his name's sake. It's not about us. Realization. Your forgiveness rests on God's mercy, his mercy alone. Recognition that forgiveness isn't really so much about us. We are forgiven, yes, individually, yes, but it's for his name's sake. And then also, David takes responsibility. He takes responsibility for his own actions and how that's impacted others. Look at what happens here in verse 18. He says, consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. Now, he's linking some things together here. Consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive my sins. What caused the affliction and the trouble? His sins, right? David had made a mess out of things. He made a mess, and he's owning that, recognizing that. We have a way sometimes of making our lives harder than they need to be, right? We foolishly don't use our time well, and then we have to scramble at the last minute to get things done, or we don't use our money well, and so we end up being short on things that are important. David is saying, I've made a mess. I've made a mess, Lord. And I need you to consider that. I need you to help me clean this thing up. Now, we've already talked about a number of instances in David's life that could be specifically driving this, and we don't know exactly. But perhaps it was with his family, with his son Amnon and Absalom, and the son that he lost even before birth with his sin with Bathsheba. And there are a number of stories where David sinned, and he sinned greatly, and they brought about affliction and trouble. It's for this reason that he needs the Lord to forgive him. This is really a nice little paradigm for us to think through with our own sin, right? Lord, we realize that our forgiveness rests only on you. Lord, we recognize that our forgiveness is ultimately for you and for your name's sake. And Lord, we own responsibility. We take responsibility for where our sin has caused problems, to where it's made a mess. We take responsibility ultimately for that. Brings us to the last part of this particular psalm. We see this idea of animosity and comfort. And we'll look at these verses just for a moment and then relate these things to the life of Jesus. Verse 19, consider how many are my foes and with what violent hatred they hate me. David had legitimate enemies. This is hard for us maybe to process and think through because most of us probably don't have someone that's seeking to kill you at this particular moment in time. Most of us probably are not living in that way. But you've experienced animosity in your life. You've experienced the being shunned and ostracized by family. Some of you may experience that this week, as many of us will see relatives and friends and family that we haven't seen this holiday week. We experience this. There are people that hate us just because of what we stand for, standing ultimately for the Lord. I would just encourage you in a 1 Peter sort of way, if they revile you for the sake of Christ, that's okay. Just don't let them revile you for being evildoers, right? Don't go flying through Atlantic Beach doing 70 and then say I'm getting pulled over because I'm a Christian. All right, that's not how that works, right? So don't make up things. If you're punished for being an evildoer, well, that's just on you. But if you're reviled and you're persecuted and you're ostracized for the sake of Christ, good for you. Good for you. And may the Lord give his comfort as you walk through that animosity. Let's think through this in the life of Christ, which will lead us into our time of the Lord's table. We see trouble and deliverance. We see that Jesus experienced the ultimate trial, but he did it on our behalf. He was ultimately delivered by the Lord. his troubles were more numerous than we can possibly count. He walked through that for us. Truth and guidance. Jesus walked by the Spirit of God perfectly. He only spoke that which the Father gave him to speak. He perfectly modeled trust in the Lord, even to the point of crucifixion. Sin and guilt. Jesus never sinned, so he was not a sinner. He did not deserve punishment for sin. Yet, it was he who bore our sin on the cross. He who knew no sin became sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Jesus wasn't guilty. David was guilty. Jesus wasn't guilty. Animosity and comfort. Jesus experienced the ultimate animosity and hatred towards him. He was reviled. He was beaten. He was tormented in reality, tortured and killed. And yet he walked with integrity and uprightness. Hebrews 12, verse 2 says this, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. He despised the shame. He took the shame on himself and he said, I will bear that. Why? Because of the comfort and joy that's available at the end. Leads us into our time to celebrate the Lord's table today. It's always such a good time together as a church family, and there's such a unifying effect of celebrating the Lord's table together. And in reality, that's what it was designed to do, is to bring us together around the centrality of the gospel. This morning, we practice here something called open communion here at the church. And that means if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, we invite you to participate with us in communion. If you don't know if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you're not sure where you stand with the Lord, or if you're living in open, rebellious sin against the Lord right now, we would just ask you to observe this morning and don't participate in the Lord's table. Such a great reminder. It's a time for us to remember what the Lord has done through the elements, that he gave his body, that he gave his blood on our behalf.